Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 16th. Today's session is entitled Lord of the Landfill, God of the Garbage Heap, Session 3 of Poetry and the Power of Healing of Salvage and Detritus, presented by Steve Ringo, number RIS 2003-03. Let's listen in.
This is fun. Nice to be cozy. It's nice to be cozy. Burn it, Carol. But session 3 of the Poetry and the Healing Power of Salvage and Detritus. And I welcome you. If you if you don't have a handout, there's a stack right there, and a stack right there, and a stack right there. Did I say my name?
No.
There's a pile of the handout that you need there, Caius, there. To start out, I'd like to say this poem / prayer that's on the board together. It's by a Seattle area poet and artist named James Bertolini. I think he has a poem going, and then he went and did that We've Got to Try thing that sounds more like changes it. But that's okay. I still love it. So can we say that together? Can you read my writing?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
To survive,
our minds must taste redwood and agate, octopi, bat, and in the bat's mouth, insect. It's hard to think like a planet.
We've got to try. So I put words in your mouth, didn't I? But he's saying you got to put insect in your mouth and the taste of redwood and the agate, and that to become one with nature is something even deeper. I like the food-like way he does this, with the way food is talked about and practiced here too, and however you practice food. There's something very intimate about what you put in your mouth and how we feed ourselves and are fed. So the theme of the day, as you see there, Lord of the Landfill, God of the Garbage Heap. I'm trying to use the G sounds and the L's, but really that serves the meaning. The word landfill is a very strange, I guess it's a euphemism. What do you picture when you hear the word landfill? Anybody?
I think of smell.
Smell. What else?
Garbage. Piles.
Piles. Expansive piles. What else?
Waste.
Seagulls.
Scavengers.
All sorts of creatures.
Bulldozers.
Diesels. Plumes going up. How many of you have been to a landfill? Some haven't. Okay. It's worth doing. Not out of any, I don't find it to be a magical mystery tour. For me, I don't go there for fun. But it's I do love crows, however, and there are many crows there too. So if you want to watch the crows, that's one place you know you can do it. Let's jump right in today. We've been going through poems each day with a packet like this and talking a little bit about junk and stuff and how it relates to the created order and the redemption of things and the redemption of the world and the liberation of things leading to our own liberation and our own healing and such. Good. A Cabinet of Seeds Displayed, Howard Nimeroff. I'll read this one, but I will ask some of you to read if you're brave and if you flip ahead and you get bored with what we're doing, find a poem that really lights your brain up and your feelings, and maybe you'll read that one, who knows. A Cabinet of Seeds Displayed. These are the original monies of the earth, in which invested as a spark in fire, they will produce a green wealth toppling tall, a trick they do by dying, by decay, in burial, becoming each his kind, to rise in glory and be magnified a million times above the obscure grave. Reader, these samples are exhibited for contemplation, locked in potency and kept from act for reverence's sake. May they remind us while we live on earth that all economies are primitive, and by their reservations, may they teach our governors who speak of husbandry and think the hurricane where power lies. Impressions right off, anybody? There's no right answers. We do a lot of talking about these, so if you haven't been here, free and open discussion.
In catastrophes, there's rejuvenation.
Okay, yeah. Death and destruction before life. That's a very prophetic theme too. And the prophets, always a dying before a rising. Destruction upon Israel, destruction upon your temples, and then rebuilding.
Message to the politicians.
Okay, where do you see that?
Governors.
Mm-hmm. And the economies?
You speak, you know, they don't know where the power is.
I thought of Yetta's titles in presentations, just the word economies, you know. That, how many times do you see that word in a poem?
This is a great use of that. All economies are primitive and the seed case, because in a way, I mean, what this poem is saying in that other context, wealth, where does real wealth come from? I mean, it has to come from the earth, it has to come from plants that are born over and over.
The fullness of the land, not the landfill. And, so the title gives you a clue, Cabinet of Seeds. There's something about order and structure here, right? It's a cabinet of seeds. They're kind of categorized or somehow systematized, but these, right at the beginning, these seeds are the original monies. There's your economy again, right?
Well, in the cabinet, as the cabinet of officers that the president chooses.
Nice.
The supposedly seat of power.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Well, all the images of money, the first word monies, then green wealth, you know.
Invested.
A million times, yeah.
Produce, as in produce.
The currency of the earth are the natural resources.
What line, what I'm working on is that closing line, governors who speak of husbandry and think the hurricane. I take it it's a critique that they think of hurricane as if that's where power lies instead of seeds. But why did
husbandry?
Is the word husbandry there?
Well, I think of plant husbandry and animal husbandry. Boy Scouts, as I grew up, a Boy Scout, we use that a lot. It's a term.
Animal husbandry.
Yeah, I didn't know you applied to farming. Plants. You do husbandry? I thought
the horticulturalist at the prison where I work does, but that's prison.
But do governors ever speak of husbandry? I mean, that's
No.
That's,
but he's, I think he's. And maybe familial, family, husband, control, authority, but maybe in a way that's, what does he call it, the true power, the true potency, is in families and units of whatever that family means. I don't think he means beaver cleaver, but he, that the economies are primitive and simple in families, the same way they are in seeds.
The line being that these seeds should teach the governors who are seeking control that, and thinking the hurricane, where power, true power lies, and true power doesn't lie with them. That's
the hurricane is the drama, the big, the huge destructive force, but the other one is this little husbandry. I think of William Carlos Williams' poem about saxifrage, the little tiny flower that breaks the roots, that breaks the concrete, that breaks. There's a small little poem about this tiny plant that'll break through it all. And that's a very gospel thing. The mustard seed, the tiniest of seeds that becomes the biggest of kingdoms, the grandest plan.
Well, and unstoppable nature. Spirit, really.
I like that, unstoppable. Thank you.
You know, there's a lovely ending there. The governor thinks of the hurricane where power lies. The poem is telling us to teach the governors where power lies. And so the last phrase is working one way for the misguided and another way for us readers who have seed insight.
The seed of an idea. The seed of all that. It's wonderful, I think. He even addresses us, reader. Very direct. Here's what I want.
This is an English writer, English speaking
years. Yeah, he is. I could go on, but I'll try to wrap it up. But the economy is always a... once in a rare while, I try to use the Greek, 4 years of Greek I got in me somewhere. In oikonomia, I think it is, Maureen, where the word ecumenism even comes from the word for economy, which really comes from the word for house or family or husbandry is even related. So house economy is very simple. The simplest economies are maybe the best, but ecumenical as a household, even a variety of people under one roof. So other thoughts?
I like the locked in pregnancy. Mm-hmm. Because it, you know, makes it very clear that the power of the seeds is not diminished by right. putting them in a cabinet. Mm-hmm. The potency is still there.
It's waiting.
Yeah.
Pregnant or who knows, yeah. Let's move to how a metaphor can save your life. Sounds like something you read in the at the supermarket tabloid, right? How metaphor can save your life. Who would like to read this? Anybody?
Sure. You are drowning. Someone throws you an inflatable sunset, which momentarily distracts you from the sinking ship. The cramp in your left leg, the barracuda who has just sidled up next to you. You forget you do not know how to swim. You're thrashing about, your simulated swimming strokes bring out the Coast Guard. You find a small tumor behind your left earlobe. The dark cloud of cancer descends just as the doctor tells you you have Dutch elm disease and need to wash more frequently behind your ears. You have just lost your job. You have no money in the bank. Eat love, someone has written on the bulletin board at the unemployment office. A man proposes on the hard bench. You accept and live happily ever afterward. You are on an airplane. Suddenly it hits an air pocket and drops 1,000 feet into a cloud bank. You climb out of the window. You have always wanted to touch a cloud. You hold yourself aloft by doing yoga. Soon your parachute opens. You sail softly, safely through a grove of redwood trees. Your arms full of
cumulonimbus
towers from the cloud bank. You learn that the Dow Jones is up.
Back to economy, aren't we? Uh-huh. Title. Somebody read that again. Thank you for reading.
Metaphor can save your life.
Okay. Sort of a how-to approach, right? Self-help.
This reminds me of James Tate.
It does. I think I can see that. What impressions or first reactions or responses do you get, or what jumps out at you? What do you like? What disturbs you? Anything?
The humor.
The humor is nice, huh? The voice. You did a wonderful job reading too. Thank you.
Especially like the second stanza about the tumor. Mm-hmm. You can feel the dread coming on, and all of a sudden.
Yeah. I know. Inflatable. Someone throws you an inflatable
sunset.
That's
an interesting metaphor. That's a great metaphor.
What's she saying here? What points might... There's not a right answer when I say that. I just want... What messages? What does she have to say?
You think of advertising when they're trying to sort of fool you.
Look at the title as your real clue, I think. How can metaphor do this? What the Dutch elm disease is the best example, I think. The cancer, the news, but metaphor, if you can see it as part of life, I'm just a tree, I'm an elm tree, anyway. If you can use your imagination and metaphor to re-vision and re-see, like Dale's been talking about, ways of seeing, if you can see the object, see the part of your life in another way. It's right out of rational emotive therapy, even really, to behavioral change. If you're going to change behavior, you have to re-see something about yourself and see it, the old having been, okay, I don't want that. I want to do this. But to do that, you can't just pull up your bootstraps.
No.
So she's saying metaphor can help you re-see yourself, your faith, your God, the junk on the hill, the neighbor next door, the person in your family, the person down the hall in the dorm,
your parent, your child, all of that, to re-see it, the metaphor. It doesn't mean it's real, it's still a metaphor. Mm-hmm. But it can lead you to a new reality. It really can. Yeah. But I don't think it's a tongue-in-cheek title. She means it. But it's sort of tongue-in-cheek with the humor, because it sounds like that over, you know, the over-the-top promises. Mm-hmm. I like the way she blends us with nature the same way. Here, even the same word that we read, we opened with this poem. Redwood is, where is it? Taste redwood, become the tree. And don't we do that when you're in nature or when you're in the city? If your mind wanders, you find that, don't you find pleasure or healing or hope in finding new ways to think about things, or you see a new thing? I think that can be healing. Metaphor can do that. Preaching to the choir, huh?
Steve, that second line, the inflatable sunset, do you see that as the sunset, the beautiful sunset, saves a person from just feeling, my life is going down the tube, I'm drowning, there's this cramp, there's this ship, there's this barracuda. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's something is made light of there and made fun of, but when I first, my first reaction to that was, the sunset, the beautiful sunset, protects you from, you know, raises you from going down with all this other stuff.
Yeah.
But when it's going down, it's called inflatable, then you think, well, maybe I'm reading that wrong. You know.
I think maybe inflatable, and we can all guess, but maybe she uses the word inflatable to enhance that power of imagination at the beginning of the poem. That, mm-hmm. that it's the imagination that inflating the mind almost, that mm-hmm. the mind is, by metaphor, you can blow it up the way you blow up
the inflatable raft,
yeah.
Raft.
Yeah, sure.
But I do think that sunset is an interesting image because it goes both ways. It can be the sunset of your life, the dying mm-hmm. of the sun, that Osiris, Isis Osiris thing, or all sorts of ways that you can see that sunset. But I think she takes us a little bit of roller coastery. To match the title, there's a roller coaster feeling of the really bad and the really good, you know, cancer and the beautiful sunset, and yeah.
I would think of it like you're lurching through life, which mm-hmm. is the way I feel about my life.
Yeah.
It's true. It's
yeah.
Not steady stride.
Huh? Oh, absolutely. There's a Margaret Atwood poem I need that just popped into my head that really connects to this. I'll have to find it, where she steps through a window and she's in a movie and it's. Is about this kind of this drama queen stuff, and I'll see if I can dig that up.
The line in the first stanza that we're looking at, where you forget that you do not know how to swim.
Right.
It's really wonderful because if you are given some beauty or something where you're taken out of yourself, uh-huh. where the thought, right. the overwhelming thought that you can't overcome something, you can't mm-hmm. overcome cancer, you don't know how to swim, you know, all of those kind of things. You can get in this way through metaphor where you forget what you don't know.
And thus overcome it.
Then you overcome it in other things possible. I think that's.
Yeah. I love the way you said that. That's great. Yeah, that is good.
This poem also sort of seems almost like an antidote to the fear poem. Because again, she's, you know, there's this really fearful situation.
Right.
And yet she's able to transform it.
Mm-hmm. I thought of that too. Yeah. So, metaphor can save your life. Whoa, that's a pretty big promise. Some of you maybe have an affection for Rumi. Can we go on to Rumi? Anybody familiar with Rumi? He's become pretty popular. 13th century, I believe. Persian Empire, Sufi, whirling dervish, that whole kind of ambiance. One of the true mentors, or what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of gurus. What's in the
bodies of wisdom? One of the great quotes is, "Let the beauty that we love be what we do."
Mm-hmm. There you go. Nice.
Kind of has been following me around with the healing of the world thing. Mm-hmm. You know,
good.
It fits right in there.
Yeah, that's nice. He. there's not a lot that's known about Rumi as biographical, but in the writings, I've read probably, I've tried to read almost everything of his in 1 year, but where was I going with that? The friend, the beloved, he mentions over and over through his poetry, the friend, the beloved. There's a lot of speculation among scholars about whether that's God or another abbey, in a monastic partner or friend, or some have said it's a gay relationship, some have said it's a lover he wasn't supposed to be having. Who knows? And I don't know that it matters. I tend toward the God, and that's maybe just where I come from, so, but it, maybe it doesn't matter, but think about that for 20 years. Yeah. who would like to read Rumi, anybody? It's not an easy read. I'll read it. Look, fish. I saw the friend clearly, and I stopped reading books and memorizing poems. I quit going to church, and I quit fasting to be a better person. I quit worrying about when I should be praying. I saw how I was undisciplined and toxic. I saw how lovely and strong. No mercy for the drunk, a full sentence. Let the beautiful one come out in fine clothes, wind his hair into God's rope, twist the braids into a cross for Christians to see, whose light is better than the sun's. How could he have gotten so withered and weak? Now he jokes and pounds the table. He was wine under a lid, Joseph at the bottom of the well. Know yourself in the light of the true ones, as the ground sees its face in a garden, as rock knows its own secret, put next to a ruby, iron next to polished steel. Come into existence. Flies go round to every pile of dung, and finally, out of that compost, the Anya bird, the true man. When a person is born of this new moment, it does not wear off tomorrow. Sit with lovers and be useful. Don't wander away. Look, fish, at the ocean behind you. Go back where you came from, sea creature. You hear the sound of water, and you know where you want to be. Why wait? You've gone places you regret going, for money and such. Don't do that again. Water says, live here. Don't carry me around in buckets and pans. False duties. Rest and be quiet. A lot of religious feeling and language, I think. Even Christian allusions here. Response. Do you have a response? I think Rumi takes a lot of time and digesting. It's not an easy brain, you know, kind of a deep image poet of the 13th century like Merwin might be. Anyone want to say something you responded to, even some just one little thing?
I responded right away to the first two lines. Okay. The first line, in the sense that I think what he's saying is, you know, when I have this immediate experience, I have no need for anything that's a translation or an intermediary or a path.
Right.
All of a sudden, there.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that it's the first thing in the poem, that you don't go through the whole poem.
He starts there. Toxic, undisciplined. The landfill idea, toxicity. And not just to the land. I mean, the landfill is out there, but who fills it? Right? Yeah, we make it. It's our responsibility. It's our creation. The ground. In the middle of the poem there, know yourself in the light of the true ones. As the ground sees its face in a garden, I think that he becomes rooted here in the stuff of the world, the garden and its own mirror, the rock with its secrets inside, ruby, iron, polished steel. I picked it partly for this stanza of the connection to the stuff of the created order and this, the groundedness of that. The old seeds that died in the Nemiroff poem, come back in here, when a person is born of this new moment from the compost, that seed thing happens. It's germinating. There's the death of the seed, but there's the rebirth under fire.
Seems to me one of the big themes in it is just the connection with nature, period.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Know yourself in the light of, you know, the true ones. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what that part means, but as the ground and, you know, you wrench and all those things, and then in the next stanza about the flies and when the person is born of this new mm-hmm. moment.
Yeah.
Coming back to the earth.
Yeah.
The dawn and all the
immediacy with the world and God. I would bridge those into a triangle. God, me, world, all of it at that moment of immediacy. And the mystic seeks those moments. Actually doesn't seek. The mystic waits and watches, this antenna waiting, you know, and kind of a mystic is really not staring for it as much as knowing it's going to creep up around behind me, and I want to listen carefully enough so I hear it when it comes creeping around behind me, because otherwise I'm going to miss it. Yeah.
Well, I really like the part about the fish in the third stanza.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to mention that. And then in the first stanza, I thought it was kind of interesting how he says, I saw how I was undisciplined and toxic. I saw how lovely and strong.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of controversial.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
What do you make of that?
Well, I don't know.
It's
kind of seeing both sides.
Maybe it's the whole thing. The good and the bad. Christians have a way of saying that with the simile justus et peccator, it's all good and bad in this world. He's not dichotomizing a world of the good. And a lot of mystics have over the centuries, and not just mystics, but theologians, where you have the matter is good or evil, and it's black and white, sort of. And he's saying all of this, that it's all redeemable, like we talked about yesterday. It's all in God's purview and God's splendor. And even in the landfill, I think Rumi would be celebrating. But what he'd say is, I like the way you said it, Chris, with the ground under your feet. And the fish, Mari touched on that. I love that fish part too.
Yeah.
This huge ocean. Was there the fear poem yesterday on the edge of the ocean?
Yeah.
Here's this huge ocean again. Look, fish, and we become the fish, the reader, at the ocean behind you. This little floating thing.
I'm seeing in that previous stanza connection with that too, know yourself in the light of the true ones,
mm-hmm.
as the ground sees its face in a garden. But the ground is there feeling kind of cloddy.
Mm-hmm.
But the garden is
sure.
The beautiful thing that comes right out of the ground, just like the
compost.
The ruby is the beautiful thing that comes right out of the rock.
Yeah.
And the rock and the ground are trying to learn to see that, I don't know if it's an idealized, but the true ones in themselves, they contain the beautiful thing. And I guess the iron and steel work the same way. The iron is the less finished thing, and the polished steel is the beautiful thing that's...
I think that answers Mari's question too, if Mari was listening.
If only, yeah.
And we got that on tape, Mari.
Well, I think, like, to you all been getting back to Croy's point about the fish, and her comment in the first stanza about, you know, I'm just going to talk sick, lovely, and strong.
Mm-hmm.
It almost seems to me that the poet's saying, see your nature. That's
mm-hmm.
where this immediate moment is going to come from.
Yeah.
And your nature is both the rock and the ruby.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good. Wonderful. Did that make sense? Or are you truly worth listening? Uncles can do that to their niece, right?
I like that come into existence, that invitation at the end of that section
yeah.
that Mori was just talking
yeah.
about. That's really powerful.
If you like that, I would invite you to get a Rumi, get some Rumi. Barks does most of the translating in English, at least American translations that I've seen for Rumi, but the best is W.S. Merwin. He's done some of Rumi translations. I think he's just, that's my bias, obviously. Everything I say is my own bias, right? But W.S. Merwin does a wonderful job with Rumi, too. And any of you David James Duncan fans? The River Y,
oh, yeah.
Brothers K, River T. In the River Y, Rumi is a thread all the way through the River Y. quotes of Rumi, and he uses the Merwin translations, I might add. So, there you be. Let's not skip, because we skipped Cairns last time. So let's keep marching through in such an orderly fashion. Scott Cairns, the poem Reason. Before we jump in on that, he is an interesting person, and his book, his most recent book of poems is in the bookstore, and I have no idea why it's so highly priced, because it's a used copy that feels new, but I swear I got a new copy for less than the used ones. And I should have said that yesterday too. All the books that I brought with me are on reserve in the library if you want to peruse any of them. And if you want to, did I say that on day one? If you want to take it away from the library, please ask me first, but they are on reserve to look at in the library. And Scott Cairns, I have two of his books of poems in there. The interesting thing about him, and I'll try to be brief about this, was that he's a very theological poet, which is hard to find anymore, a good, solid, recognized poet that's in the mainstream of modern poetry in America. He's there, and I mean that, and I think he's genuine. Got a good voice, all that, but he's not afraid to bring Christian theology in, kind of like a T.S. Eliot of our day in some ways. Anyway, he applied for a job at Seattle Pacific University in Seattle as a literature and poetry professor, full tenured track, interviewed, and was accepted. Did you hear about this?
I did.
It caused quite a stir in Seattle, because just before he started, after signing contracts, he was the board hastily gathered at Seattle Pacific and said, we cannot hire this person, because there were in some of his poems from 5 years ago or whatever, there were these erotic allusions in the literature, in the writing that were, and I've read them, they are erotic, but they're not double, triple X, they're just erotic allusions, like a Rumi would have tons of, so Rumi couldn't teach at SPU either. Anyway, it caused a good stir in a lot of ways, because, and probably it was good for his career, actually, and it hit the national press, it was in the Christian Century, there was a long article about this whole debate about Christian art, Christian poetry, Christian thinking in a school of literature, in a four-year college that's respected. Political questions come into play, obviously, but if that interests you, there is a February article of Christian Century that discusses this at length, and there was a poem of his in our first session that we didn't get to, if you go back and read that one. And like I said, the book is for sale. And two of his books are on reserve, but
so he ended up not teaching.
He ended up not taking the job. He could have probably gone to court.
Yeah.
It seemed that they were rejecting him for the erotic allusions rather than the Christianity. I mean, another liberal arts college would reject him for being too Christian.
Right.
Yeah. It's there.
Yeah.
You can imagine how much debate it triggered. And the Seattle area prides itself for open-mindedness and books.
Not just for you.
Yeah. Well, I know, but I said the Seattle area.
Yeah.
So it caused a good debate, a very good debate.
You know where he is now?
He is in West Tennessee.
Oh,
yeah.
Where's he originally from?
He's from Seattle. Oh, that's I got to tell you this part too. He grew up near Bellingham or in Seattle, but went to college. His four-year studies were at Western Washington University, Bellingham. If you're a Washington person, you know where Bellingham is. And it just so happened that he needed a literature class. And he was not into literature at all. He's kind of a sociology person. I need a literature class, throw one in. And this advisor said, well, take that one. And he just threw it in there. And he walked into class the first day not knowing who this was sitting in front of his class. It was Annie Dillard. She was doing a guest teachership at Western, because that was her period of time where she spent a bunch of months on the San Juan Islands. And there, I guess Annie Dillard just took a can opener to his brain, he just felt like every day his brain just exploded, and his heart and everything. And he talks about it as a huge moment of change in faith and in literature and art and I didn't know this was there. He saw, you know, the metaphor changed his life. And from then on, he went on to graduate school and became a poet.
Yeah.
All because...
So how old are
they? I think he's in his late 40s. That's my guess.
I was there back then.
Yeah.
I don't remember being there.
Yeah, she was up there.
Yeah, it was maybe just a 2-month thing. So it was very providential or chaos.
Right.
Chance, is that for, was that... And the advisor telling him, we'll take that one.
Right.
The advisor didn't have a clue probably who Annie Dillard was either. Yeah. So, I'll read it. Reason. It could be a late night phone call or a note you find troubling the bed. It could be a telegram you can't help going back to. But something has died or has left you, and you can't remember which. You do know that you sit alone, that you have 10 strange fingers, and that something whistles in your lungs. Odd, the way a face hangs so heavily and can seem to pull you over, can seem to pull you down. If your hand were to change, become something altogether different, say, a grip of flowers or a club of dirt, you might understand the strangeness. Might say out loud, there, that's the problem. Something's changed my hand to dirt.
Oh, sweet.
Isn't that sweet?
So sweet?
What do you think? Say some more.
Well, when you read the last song, I laughed, and then I went back to the cut, and I thought, of course, that's a struggle all the time, is trying to find reason and logic and understanding for oftentimes these things that are just can't be nailed down anymore.
Yeah, it's just, it happens.
It happens, yeah.
You think of the fish, I know there's a lot of ways, but I thought of the fish too. This time when I read it, I thought of Rumi's fish with all that behind there. Oh yeah, there.
Yeah.
That's the ocean here, and the fish is surrounded in the ocean. I like the way he leads you to that too. If your hand were to change, it becomes something altogether different. He's just lathing these lines. Say, for example, kind of just blithely, a grip of flowers or a club of dirt and strangeness. It's again about the metaphor, how the metaphor can change your life, I think.
It's also, we have these feelings and we're settling them, so we're not quite right or accessing the questions or whatever. And sometimes we really want there to be, you know, something wrong that we could point to, an illness or, you know, where we could go and say to the world, look, there's something wrong.
Reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah. Explanations. And they're fairly overrated usually.
Yeah.
Or inaccurate over time, tested over time. Someone had a hand up over here. There are better poems of his, but I like the way this connected to the theme and then back to this, the dirt and the landfill, the earth, very grounded again in the earth. First article is what?
Creation.
God, the maker. But then he's talking about redeeming our minds or being redeemed of mind or having a new vision, seeing it different so you can be healed, so you can be different, or so you can grow, whatever.
He's also talking about the human inability to fully capture that.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it almost seems to be starting up the third arc.
Absolutely.
This unknowable, can't pin down, you know, thing that makes.
Yeah, the title of the book is Figures for the Ghost, the Spirit. Yeah.
And I would say that I feel like the poem is about the desire to understand it, or the drive to have some way to frame it and say, okay, now I get it.
Right.
And if only the hand changed to dirt, you could. Then you have something to say.
Isn't that the way we feel in the face of like death? Right? Somebody dies and there's just no way to say
And I think death is here too. There's the late night phone call.
Right, that telegram.
You know, that's often about death.
Something has died as well.
I mean, the whole Genesis thing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
out of dust.
The irony here is that we do turn the dirt. Mm-hmm. The hand does turn the dirt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you could just, you want to be really crass and for somebody died, you say, why is this happening?
Yeah.
We need more dirt. You know what I mean? You know.
Yeah.
That's.
Sure. I agree. Ashes to ashes and then being breathed into the dust of life. But I do think that I have read this poem and tried to read it as a almost that he's saying it from the grave, that from the grave, here I am in this casket, and my hands turned to dirt. And you could see it that way. I think he maybe makes it to go either way. Let's go to Mr. Sinek. He's the one that wrote the fork poem yesterday, if you remember the fork crept right out of hell or whatever.
There's another hand that has more.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
The eyeless beakless.
Uh-huh. Who would like to read Stone?
I'll read it.
Okay.
Stone. Go inside a stone. That would be my way. Let somebody else become a dove or gnash with a tiger's tooth. I am happy to be a stone. From the outside, the stone is a riddle. No one knows how to answer it. Yet within, it must be cool and quiet. Even though a cow steps on it full weight, even though a child throws it in a river, the stone sinks, slow, unperturbed, to the river bottom, where the fishes come to knock on it and listen. I have seen sparks fly out when two stones are rubbed. So perhaps it is not dark inside after all. Perhaps there is a moon shining from somewhere, as though behind a hill, just enough light to make out the strange writings, the star charts on the inner walls.
I think in a roundabout way, he's inviting us to see that mystery, to see those metaphors, to try to see the deeper life underneath the things of the world, to dig underneath the landfill, to dig underneath the mind, all of it. What do you think? Go inside a stone.
The stone seems like on the surface it would not be any big mystery.
Right.
A lot of people don't even pay attention to them.
Ordinary.
Yeah.
Clod.
Whereas you could pick something a lot more metaphorical or beautiful or mysterious, but a stone is, you know, unless it's a precious jewel, mm-hmm. but then there's something in the ordinary that makes it really open to interpretation, mm-hmm. too, and open to a lot of metaphors, maybe.
Yeah, and the...
And it's a useful thing, too, stones.
And beautiful.
Uh-huh.
I mean, in architecture, stonework, and there's some symbolism attached to the stone over history, if you just looked at the
stone
word
age.
Stone Age.
Stony people.
The stone has this whole inner life. That is imagined that you don't see in the whole first way of looking at it is mm-hmm. that you just see the outside of it, you know, stone
right.
sinking unperturbed and so on, but the inner life that's suggested by the sparks then are like strange cave writings mm-hmm. or the inner life of the cosmos. You're
right.
looking at those
yeah.
stars and picturing something.
Yeah, macrocosm and microcosm sort of thing. Yeah.
About the stone, it doesn't really do much itself. It has people do, you know, like in most of the examples here, you have to throw it, or the cow steps on it, or the fishes knock, or it's rubbed.
Right.
It kind of has other things act upon it, which is sort of an interesting thought.
The cow.
Yeah.
Inanimate, yeah.
And then it's on the wall, and there's writings. And
sinking,
you know,
in the water.
It doesn't really take an active part, where it's what you bring to it, maybe. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
I hear that
image
of stone
cry
out.
Yeah, good connection. That's great. The stone's
like
cry.
With the strange writings, a star chart on the inner walls.
Mm-hmm.
That's really fantastic.
That's a beautiful image.
That reminds me of it's the beginning of Grinch Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And the old man is looking at the shelves. Trying to same. Mm. And the markings on the shoulders, they look so much like writing. Mm. And this actually seems to me that in that same tradition, it's like, rather than being like a bird or something excited, to go inside the most silent of things, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and to look at it from a completely different point of view from inside the self, mm-hmm. there must, you know, there would be, you know, in some measured way, mm-hmm. a message to us,
yeah.
You know, a light, a way of understanding,
yeah.
That would lead us to understand the mystery of creation.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Yeah, the ancientness is, the time thing is so fascinating right, with rocks, too.
And there are some things you can open in the Thunder Age, you mm-hmm. know, crystals inside, and all that. Mm-hmm. But,
yeah.
Also, this, this is just by the way, and we can probably talk about another time, but the voice of this sounds so like refuge to me.
Yeah, I can see that.
And God bless the song.
Mm-hmm.
The
rocks, so. Mm-hmm. I can see that.
Well, I kind of think of it as a metaphor, the whole thing. We're just talking. And you know, when there are people who you tend not to notice.
Mm-hmm.
And
true.
Inside them, they're like gems and jewels and, mm-hmm. and they're being shiny. Sometimes it takes the interaction with another
mm-hmm.
stone
right.
mm-hmm. to bring those sparks out.
Mm-hmm.
That's good.
That's beautiful. Yeah.
Well, there's also lots of geologic history inside a stone. I mean,
yeah.
it's amazing.
It is.
History from the very beginning. Mm-hmm.
Archives of, it's kind of an archival repository. Yeah. Good. We are God's house of living stones. Mm-hmm. Another scriptural allusion. Let's go onward. We're going to actually make it. No, we aren't going to make it today. All right. We might. We've got about 10 minutes here. Antler is a Ogallala Sioux Native American poet. I think he's Ogallala. I'll read this one.
Ogallala?
That's a tribe.
Where is that located?
It's Dakotas,
Dakotas
and,
yeah.
and Nebraska, I think.
Yeah.
Is that accurate?
Okay.
Yeah. Are you from there? Mm-hmm. Good. I think as we read this, it harks back to some of those fiscal and financial allusions of the first poem we looked at today. Was that the first one or the second one? I think it was the first one. Prove to me, in a single blizzard, more snowflakes fall than all the money produced in the history of the world. In a single fall, more leaves fall than all the money produced in the history of the world. In this universe alone, not counting universes before and after, and universes concurrent with this universe, more planets with utopias on them exist than all the money produced in human history. Explain to me why snow can't be used as money. Explain to me why each fallen leaf can't be pecuniary remuneration. Prove to me beyond the shadow of a doubt why the epiphany, zillions of planets have utopias on them, can't be legal tender. Why can't I fill my cart with food and after the girl rings up my bill, give her a pine cone? Why can't I knock on my landlord's door and hand him a flower for rent? And when the police take me away and demand to see my identification, what else can I do but reach into my pocket and present them a handful of sand running through my fingers? I love the ID part, and back to that biblical, our identification is through God who breathes his life into us out of the ground, right? The creation is out of the ground in the dust, and the death is back to the ground. So it's much more, our ID really, truly, is genuinely from the ground, but the money, the fiscal, the legal tender, the pecuniary remuneration. Now let's read the other one, since we're on the same poet. It kind of dovetails nicely. And you see the hummingbirds around the village so much. That's partly why I picked this one, too. Mother hummingbird thought. The hummingbird hovers momentarily in the rusty hulk of a car that plunged off the highway into the deep canyon years ago, and no one knows about. She perches on the skull of the driver and thinks, perhaps one of these eye holes would be a safe place for a nest. A little morbid, yeah?
Yeah, definitely.
But life out of death again, isn't it? Life and death. What kind of hummingbird is it?
Mother.
Mother, there you go. Life. And she's looking for what?
Safe
place for a nest. I love the way the car becomes detritus. The car is gone so, and the car is such a symbol in our culture of, you know, status. Every kind of status you'd ever want, you can find in a car. And I love cars too. But here this car goes off the cliff. Nobody knows the driver is dead. Nobody knows where he is, and he's gone to seed. What's left is bone, right? Mm-hmm. What a very safe place. I mean, it's the skull, the eye hole, the car. It's very, very safe. And it's very, and a hummingbird is a magical bird too. And cultures, some of the Middle Eastern cultures, the hummingbird is a prophetic bird that brings divine messages. They do that flying thing that nothing else does. Hovers.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Also, I think it's about our purpose in life and how there's always a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Even if we don't think there is or no one's there to know about it, mm-hmm. there's always going to be something.
So the car went off the cliff because it was meant to?
Well, not maybe because it was meant to, but the hummingbird found its purpose. Mm-hmm.
It created a purpose. Even metaphor saved its life. Yeah, that's good.
He
changed the car, didn't he?
Right.
Well, it's
not
like
an auto wreck anymore. It's a home.
It's a home.
Well, it's like the junk that you take down
it's
here.
It's a birthing room.
Something else, you know?
Mm-hmm. True.
That junk didn't have to be removed to become something
it's
else.
Reclaimed and transformed.
Right, that place
it did. Yeah.
Those
very cool.
Come from me and really becomes feeling of abundance.
Good.
It's just right there.
Good.
You know, there's no seeking, and in fact, it didn't seem to me that the hummingbird was seeking. It's just that she happened to be there, and then she thought, well, what would it be?
Yeah. Even says momentarily.
Yeah.
I just kind of, hummingbirds momentarily, everything's momentarily. Nothing's too, you know, the crow will sit there for a long time.
But there's kind of a huge redemption in this safe place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it was an unsafe place for the driver and this thing goes off the cliff.
Yeah.
And it's become the safest kind of place. Mm-hmm. For the
There's so much promise.
Yeah. It would have been totally different if the period had been after place or nest had been the word rest.
Right.
It's totally different.
Yep. Yeah. It is. That's true.
I also think it's important that no one knows. But it has, mm-hmm. the safety is sort of in the mystery.
The mystery, absolutely. Yep.
Well, and it's so removed from everything that it's out of everybody's life, that's why it's.
Mm-hmm. We really have to read the next one, and then maybe we can get one more, because I picked this one for my mom. She introduced me to Dylan Thomas years and years ago, and painted a little painting on canvas, maybe about that size. She had her first exhibit of painted art in her 70s, right, Mom? About 2-3 years ago. So she's doing some new things in her 70s. That's wonderful. Even though she's been painting all those years, I think it's cool that an exhibit happened. But
sold out exhibit.
Yeah, she painted used the first stanza of this poem with some kind of abstract thing of the fuse and whatnot. But I've kept that all. She gave it to me. I don't know why I got it. Why me, Lord?
You must have liked poetry
but
then.
It still hangs up somewhere in my house. If we can move it around. Who would like to read this, Mom? No? Anybody? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Because Dylan Thomas is a favorite of mine.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
The force that through the green fuse drives the flower. The force that through the green fuse drives the flower drives my green age. That blasts the roots of trees is my destroyer. And I am dumb to tell the crooked rose my youth is bent by the same wintry fever. The force that drives the water through the rocks drives my red blood, that dries the mouthing streams, turns mine to wax, and I am dumb to mouth unto my veins, how at the mountain spring the same mouth sucks.
the hand that whirls the water in the pool stirs the quicksand, the ropes that blowing wind hauls my shroud sail, and I'm done to tell the hanging man how of my clay is made the hangman's line. The lips of time reach to the fountainhead, love drips and gathers, but the fallen blood shall calm her sword. And I am dumb to tell the weather's wind how time has ticked a heaven round the star. And I am dumb to tell the lover's tomb how at my sheet goes the same crooked worm.
Beautiful. Thank you. Dumb, as in, I am speechless. I am speechless to say how this does, how, and not just how, but that it does it. The force of life that flows through these, this plant, the green fuse, the plant branch or the twig, drive, it's the same force that drives my green age. There's the conflicting, you know, the youth versus the age, the aging body. It's the same life force in all of this, in that, in the bat, in the octopi, in the bat's mouth. It's just a celebration of this life force, but it leads you to death too.
Age and, my youth is bent by the same wintry fever.
Mm-hmm.
Youth and winter.
Yeah. It's a beautiful juxtaposition of all that dying and composting and living and the whole interconnected thing. The bottom couplet reminds me of the Shakespeare sonnet we read yesterday a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the rocks in there that hark back to Simic's poem, maybe. Spend a few years with this one, too. It will always give you back. It always will give you back. I don't know there's a poet that has better diction in the English language. His word choices, the words he uses. Now, turn the page. We're not going to have time to read it, but I would really like you to read on your own time. Scott Cairns, the Seattle Pacific wannabe guy that didn't get a shot, is there a mortuary art to walking through the cemetery and seeing the art.
Ooh, Freudian slip.
Yeah, yeah. And the landfill comes in there, too. You'll see that connection. I really want to read Lot's Wife, though, as a closing poem. And then I'll, if you need to go, you can go, but don't quite stop burning yet, Carol, please. Marble Floor on the back. Anybody know who that is?
Mm-hmm.
Trick question.
Mm-hmm.
Who is Carl Wojtyla?
Oh,
he's the Pope.
Yeah,
Pope John Paul II. This is written when he was a monk, way before he was cardinal and all that. Good poem, too. I kept trying to find a reason not to have this poem on top of Pope's poem in there. It's good. It's very good. So let's read Lot's Wife, and I just had a couple commercials for some of the others in here. It is a longer one, huh?
Okay.
Is that okay, Maury? Can you give me permission to do that?
To read this?
We might go 2 minutes over.
Oh, yeah. Go okay. For it. People can get up and
program
leave.
Coordinator said so. The turning of Lot's wife. First of all, she had a name, and she had a history. She was Mara. And long before the breath of death's angel turned her to bitter dust, she had slipped from her mother's womb with remarkable ease, had moved in due time from infancy to womanhood with a manner of grace that came to be the sole blessing of her aging parents. She was beloved. And like most daughters who are beloved by both a mother and a father, Mara moved about her city with unflinching compassion, tending to the dispossessed as if they were her own. And they became her own. In a city given to all species of excess, there were a great many in agony, abandoned men, abandoned women, abandoned children. Upon these, she poured out her substance and her care, Her first taste of despair was at the directive of the messengers, who announced, without apparent sentiment, what was to come, what was to be done. With surprising banality, they stood and spoke. One coughed into his fist and would not meet her eyes, and one took a sip from the cup she offered before he handed it back, and the two disappeared into the night. Unlike the man, coward and sycophant, the woman remained faithful unto death. For even as Lot fled the horrors of a city's conflagration, outrunning Mara and both girls as they all rushed into the desert, the woman stopped. She looked ahead briefly to the flat expanse, seeing her tall daughters, whose strong legs and churning arms were taking them safely to the hills. She saw, farther ahead, the old man whom she had served and comforted for 20 years. In the impossible interval where she stood, Mara saw that she could not turn her back on even one doomed child of the city, but must turn her back instead upon the saved. I think I'll stop there, and we can stay around and talk, but we'll end the session with a turning moment like that, with this fish in the sea behind it. And thank you for being here.